In September 2001, a young Air Force surgeon stood in the halls of Walter Reed Army Medical Center, watching as America forever changed before her eyes. In that moment of national crisis, she found her calling, not just to treat disease, but to transform how we fight it. That physician scientist is Dr. Elizabeth Mittendorf, co-director of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Robert and Karen Hale Distinguished Chair in Surgical Oncology. From engineering student athlete at Duke to pioneering immunotherapy researcher, Dr. Mittendorf's journey embodies the convergence of innovation and compassion. This legacy of leadership continues with her recent election as the incoming president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, also known as ASCO. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran from PICE. Today, on From Bench to Fireside, PICE's Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. John Connolly, explores Dr. Mittendorf's remarkable path, from her early work with the military to becoming a driving force in breast cancer immunotherapy. They'll discuss how PICE's collaborative network is accelerating breakthrough discoveries, from innovative cancer vaccines to next-generation combination therapies. Dr. Mittendorf shares her vision for more inclusive clinical trials and reflects on the power of mentorship in shaping the future of cancer research. Join us as we explore how one scientist's perseverance is helping to revolutionize cancer treatment on From Bench to Fireside.
Welcome to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, or PICE. My name is John Connolly, PICE's Chief Scientific Officer. Today I'm joined with Dr. Beth Mittendorf, who holds the Robert and Karen Hale Distinguished Chair of Surgical Oncology at Brigham and Women's Hospital and co-directs PICE's Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Beth, as you guys know, has been a pioneering force in breast cancer immunotherapy, leading groundbreaking vaccine clinical trials, including the Phase 3 PRESENT study, and innovative combination approaches with trastuzumab and HER2-positive patients. She's also pioneered much of the work in the neoadjuvant space and really advocating for immunotherapy in breast cancer. What you might not know is that Beth has served in the Air Force and has run over 20 marathons. She's absolutely this kind of determination she brings to her everyday life as well as to patients. And Beth, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So Beth, we've known you both from the MD Anderson side at PICE, as well as from now your leadership roles at Dana-Farber, but you started off as a biomedical engineer at Duke. What drew you to medicine and specifically oncology?
Yeah, thanks, John. So I actually started off at Duke. One of the main reasons I went there was because I wanted to play soccer, and they had a new women's soccer team, and I was really privileged to have the opportunity to be part of that. And I enrolled in the engineering school initially as an electrical engineer. And what I found was that I really enjoyed applying the principles, and that was biomedical engineering, and Duke has a strong program. Once I got into biomedical engineering, I realized I was sitting in a classroom, 90% of which were pre-med. It's a very common pre-med pathway. And talking to those classmates and thinking about applications of biomedical engineering, I started considering medicine as a potential career path, and then ultimately decided to go to medical school. So I wasn't one of those always wanted to be a doctor types.
Sure.
But I figured it out. I went to medical school at Case Western Reserve, which is in Cleveland, Ohio. I had just graduated from Duke, which is in Durham, North Carolina, where it's sunny all the time, great weather. My beloved Blue Devils had just won the national championship. It was all good. And I go to Cleveland, which was unbelievably cold. It was bitter. I remember walking into the medical school, you had to go between two buildings, which was like a wind tunnel. So I actually very early on in medical school questioned whether it was right for me. And so during my spring break of that first year, I was home visiting my folks in the Washington, D.C. area, and I had expressed some concern about the decision I'd made. I actually interviewed for jobs in a different industry, and one of our family friends, who's an orthopedic surgeon, said, well, why don't you come to the OR with me? I'll convince you to stay in medicine. So I said, okay, that sounds like a good plan. And so I met him at the hospital, and he said, well, meet me at the emergency room because I just got a call. Somebody has broken their wrist. So I met him in the emergency room, and I walked in, and there was this woman on the table, broken wrist, and he said, well, why don't you put her x-ray up on the view board? This is back when you actually had a view board. We weren't seeing everything on computer. And as I went to put the x-ray up, the woman cried out in pain as he was examining her, and I was so empathetic that I had a vasovagal response. I passed out. I hit my head on the counter, And while he went to the OR to do the case he had come to do, I actually stayed in the emergency room, had the ER physician sew up my lip because I'd put my tooth through it. And then I went to my dentist to get a root canal. So it was an auspicious start. And then I returned to Cleveland thinking, oh, I'm a fraud. I don't know that I can do this. And I started then on my third year rotation because you kind of alluded to it. I had an Air Force scholarship, so I was kind of tied into this. And so I started off on family medicine and I thought, well, this is probably what I'll end up doing because it's family medicine, no OR and whatnot.
Absolutely.
And in one of my first days, the family medicine doc thought he was doing me a favor by letting me do a procedure on a patient. It was giving the patient a shot. Apparently, I approached that patient with such a tremor with that needle in my hand, the patient was like, no way.
Yeah, sure.
So fast forward just a little bit. I then did OBGYN as a rotation. The first case, I again had a little issue with my vasovagal response and got all sweaty and nearly passed out. And then after that, I don't know, the next case that I was involved with was a woman with ovarian cancer, and I read and I prepared, and I was late to the case because we had a lecture, and by the time I got there, the patient was already under anesthesia, prepped and draped, so I wasn't seeing a person. I was just seeing the open abdomen and seeing what we did to help that patient by removing their ovarian cancer. Somehow that just clicked with me, and thankfully, I've not had a problem since in the OR.
That's a great story. But it's wonderful, though, that just your dedication and commitment to it, even then, even through all the fainting, you just went right back to it. I think it's a testament. And so, tell us a little bit about your time in the Air Force and Air Force patients. And is there any kind of stories as well? How did that shape your interest in both research, but also patient care?
So my time in the Air Force began in the summer of 2001. After I finished my general surgery residency, I had to go to Alabama for officer training. After finishing officer training, I reported for duty at Andrews Air Force Base, which folks may know is in the DC area. It's where the president flies in and out of on Air Force One. My second day at Andrews was September 11th of 2001. And so that obviously informed the next 4 years of my life. I had a fairly, what I would call, benign deployment myself to Germany, but I spent most of my time backfilling at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in support of the Army surgeons who had deployed first in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, then Operation Iraqi Freedom. And while I was at Walter Reed, I had the privilege of doing the general surgery clinic with the residents, but perhaps more importantly, I staffed the breast center. It was the largest breast center in the DOD, about 110 patients a year, which is not necessarily large by my current standards, but was quite meaningful. And that's where I began to become interested in breast. And with respect to how that informed some of my subsequent interests, I remember very clearly a patient that I cared for who had been treated for breast cancer about 15 years earlier, fairly early stage disease, had surgery, appropriate systemic therapy, and came back with a chest wall nodule that ended up being a recurrence. Mm-hmm. But I remember, and I don't know why, but I very clearly thought to myself, her immune system failed her. Why would I have thought that? I'm not sure. But in thinking that, I also realized that I had an opportunity at Walter Reed to work with an individual by the name of Dr. George Peoples. So George is also a surgical oncologist by training, and he had an interest at that time in vaccines. And you know, I think probably many are familiar with Steve Rosenberg's work with vaccines. He was using a pretty simple peptide vaccine, immunizing patients he was immunized people with diffuse metastatic disease, primarily melanoma, some ovarian cancer, and saw a response rate of about 4%. What George did that was a little different, he recognized that trying to use a simple vaccine, such as a peptide vaccine with GM-CSF as an adjuvant, probably wasn't going to work in the metastatic setting, but could it work earlier? And so he was, I thought, very innovative to design clinical trials that were evaluating the vaccine in patients who were rendered disease-free, so earlier stage, disease-free, but at high risk for recurrence. And so I had the privilege of becoming involved with that program while I was in the Air Force. Did some work in the lab with George, where we began to look at other peptides, started looking at the impact of other systemic therapies on potential response to vaccinations, such as trastuzumab. And really, that was kind of what set me on my way. And then George, of course, being a surgical oncologist, inspired me to complete a surgical oncology fellowship at MD Anderson, which is where I kind of then launched my own academic program.
And you were really, even early on, advocating for immunotherapy in this space, even before it was kind of mainstream therapy. It's, what was it like advocating back then and kind of pushing these vaccines at MD Anderson?
It was hard, right? I had one of my division chiefs tell me that I was immunotherapy before it was cool. So it was difficult in that the early experience with immunotherapy, as listeners will recall, was with IL-2, which was very toxic and not necessarily that effective. And so when I went to MD Anderson as a fellow, I was in the 3-year program. I was going to be going into the lab as a T32 fellow. And when I went to the program director, he literally said to me, I can't let you do that. I can't let you go in an immunology lab because that's never going to work. And so he reflected on that IL-2 experience. So I went into another lab as a T32 fellow studying cell cycle. And that was helpful in that it taught me a lot about scientific methodology and ultimately was able to secure a K99R00 award, which is what led MD Anderson, I think, in part to recruit me to remain on faculty. But part of my end of the agreement was that I was going to, as I did the transition to the R00 part, focus on immunology. And so I actually was able to negotiate with MD Anderson that as an assistant professor, they supported me in getting my PhD in immunology. And the other part to your question about how, so MD Anderson was incredibly supportive for me as a junior faculty, allowed me to get my PhD in immunology, but also a really supportive breast program that actually was very receptive to the vaccine trials. That's and great. So, yeah, so George allowed me to become the national PI on several peptide vaccine trials. And my colleagues at MD Anderson were very supportive. We enrolled quite well.
That's fantastic. And so what were the, was that the NeoTribute trial?
We initially were investigating these peptide vaccines, so peptides derived from the HER2 protein. We had two class 1 peptides we were interested in, and then a class 2 peptide. The one that got furthest along in development, E75, is a peptide from the protein's extracellular domain. And the phase 2 studies that George and I led actually led, they actually demonstrated what looked like a significant benefit to vaccination, again, in that secondary prevention space. So after standard of care, at risk for recurrence. And so that led us to design a phase 3 trial. That was the PRESENT trial. It was a 750-patient international trial that enrolled patients, again, in that same space, the patients who were disease-free but at risk for recurrence, and randomized them to vaccine or placebo. One thing that was kind of interesting, so it was a negative study in that it didn't show enough benefit to vaccination. But one thing that was interesting to me was that the vaccine performed how we thought it would. We actually, it was the control patients that did better because there had been advances in standard therapy for breast cancer patients to include the use of taxanes and aromatase inhibitors. So patients were just doing better. So we learned a tremendous amount. I would suggest that one thing I learned was that I don't think a single epitope vaccine is going to be adequate. We had thought we would get enough epitope spreading, and perhaps it was actually a benefit just to give that one peptide so the immune system didn't have to worry about processing it. And the other thing I think we learned is that GM-CSF is pretty inferior as an adjuvant, and clearly all the work that was going on at this around the same time, I mean, we were running these vaccine trials when folks like Jim Allison were really just beginning to publish and have their work actually well accepted about regulation of T cells. I think when I started, we still thought it was just two signals, and how wrong were we, right? So we learned a lot, negative studies, but yeah, I do think there's still an opportunity for vaccines.
Even though it was not mainstream, you guys were part of, I think, a great, wonderful team that was really advancing the science, as you said, getting a deeper understanding of the nature of a durable immune response that can be generated by these. So it's, and also I think one of the more important things that you've raised is just the setting in which you're doing this. Doing this in large metastatic disease settings is just hard, you know, to try to get an immune response going that's against a tumor that's been immunoselected so heavily.
No, absolutely. And in fact, I had a recent conversation with someone you know well, Bob Vonderheide at Penn. He and Susan Domchek are conducting a trial now with his TERT vaccine that is really looking at a truly preventive setting. And the thing that's so exciting about their trial, which I'm sure the Parker Institute is aware of, is not only are they enrolling patients who have BRCA mutations who have cancer, but they're enrolling BRCA patients who don't yet have cancer. And so that's kind of like a holy grail, right? Identify those at risk and vaccinate to prevent. I think some of the challenges that Bob will face in his program, much like we have in ours, is the endpoints for those trials. So using breast cancer as an example, if we look back at the last prevention trial that we did that established the role of tamoxifen as a chemo preventive agent, I mean, it's thousands of patients. And with the advances in standard of care as far as screening and whatnot, you could imagine a trial where you'd have to enroll 10,000 people and follow them for 20 years. So I think those of us interested in the science need to figure out what's probably a better marker of response to use that as our trial endpoint.
Right. It's PD markers are really, really critical here. And that's even reflecting, because that scale is not unusual for vaccinologists. You know, if we're introducing new vaccines, those trials are tens of thousands of people, but at least they have PD markers that they can identify, you know, whether it's, you know, neutralizing antibody titers or something like that. But here it's a little bit difficult to find those correlates of protection. Yeah. And I think that this is, but it's, you know, it's essential. I think that, you know, I think you'd agree that when it comes to immunology, you know, the advent of even the human race, the advent of vaccines are, you know, right up there with antibiotics and, you know, sanitation as some of the most important advances that's ever happened in the history of medicine. So if we can try to apply those to cancer immunotherapy and really get these going in a protective setting, that'd be amazing. And so one of the other advances in cancer immunotherapy that you're not just familiar with, but have been really working with is really checkpoint inhibitors. So how do you see the combination of checkpoint inhibitors and vaccines? And is this really a path forward for cancer immunotherapy?
So we talked about the potential right setting for a vaccine. And we said, you know, maybe true prevention, or I still think there's probably a role in secondary prevention. If vaccines are going to be used in metastatic disease, I would suggest it's going to be because we're trying to prime an immune response that will then be augmented with checkpoint blockade. So that's where I see in metastatic disease a possibility for vaccines in combination with checkpoint blockade. And I have a lot of enthusiasm for the potential of using a neoantigen vaccine. I think COVID and the success of the COVID vaccines really taught us a lot with respect to delivery systems. So I have enthusiasm for potentially a neoantigen vaccine leveraging mRNA as a delivery system as a way to perhaps prime a patient to respond to checkpoint blockade. Because as successful as checkpoint blockade has been, and to include in triple negative breast cancer, obviously not everybody's responding and not everybody has an endogenous immune response against their tumor that can then be, you know, enhanced with checkpoint blockade. And so that's probably where I would suggest the two of those could work together.
Yeah, kind of priming the response and then maintaining it or licensing it with the checkpoint blockade.
Yeah, I mean, when I give talks to lay audiences, I suggest that if you don't have immune cells there, if the goal of checkpoint blockade is to take the brakes off of them, what would you be taking the brakes off of? And so, yeah exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with that, you've published in the past the combination of vaccines and trastuzumab. How did this idea develop and what did you learn from those studies?
So this was a, I guess this was a bedside bench back to bedside. So in one of our phase two trials evaluating the GP2 vaccine, which was a class one, so CD8 eliciting vaccine, we enrolled patients with actually any degree of HER2 expression. So 1+, 2+, 3+. And at that time, trastuzumab had just become standard for patients with HER2 positive disease, which for listeners, just so you know, in order to be considered HER2 positive, your IHC has to be 3+. Or if you're 2+, then we do FISH to look for gene amplification. So we had patients within the trial who were HER2 negative by our clinical definition. So we're not getting trastuzumab, and HER2 positive by our clinical definition, and we're getting trastuzumab. And then they were getting the vaccine afterwards. And what we found was that in about 50 patients in whom we vaccinated after they completed their standard therapy, which would have included a year of trastuzumab, at 5 years, we did not have a single recurrence. And so, yeah, so we took this back to the lab and did a fair amount of work, which we were able to publish, showing that trastuzumab can actually enhance antigen presentation. And so suggesting it as potential synergy. And so this led then back to the clinic, and we did two additional clinical trials looking at the combination, one in patients that were HER2 positive getting trastuzumab, and we actually now, instead of vaccinating after the trastuzumab, we vaccinate at the same time. That was a negative study, and that was a very negative study. And I actually wonder if there was issue with stimulating an immune response in these HER2 3+ patients who probably already had a bit of tolerance. We also did a trial that was looking in the 1+2+ patients, giving them trastuzumab, which would not have been considered a standard. And although it was a quote-unquote negative study, it was not powered really adequately. And what we found was that for those who were HER2 1+2+ and hormone receptor negative, it did look like there was response. We had started to design a subsequent trial that would have been adequately powered to address the question, but unfortunately, the company that held the license to the vaccine at the time, we're just getting the results of that phase 3 trial that you and I spoke about earlier, the PRESENT study. And with that negative study, they stopped further development, which isn't that an interesting situation, right? And we, those of us who've been doing drug development, we see this on occasion where you have something that's promising scientifically, but perhaps not a priority for pharma.
Yeah, you see that. And I think this is really speaks to the role of, you know, pharma, it's tough to kind of steer that ship. Once they make a decision, they go in a given direction. But, you know, this is a good role for nonprofits and the academic space to begin to fund the signal finding studies that kind of take us there. And you've been at the Parker Institute now, both at the MD Anderson site in 2016, but also continue. What made you want to be part of the PICE network in the early days?
So in the early days, I got a phone call from Jim Allison asking me if I'd want to be involved with the Parker Institute. And there's only one answer to that question. And it's yes.
That'll do it.
Yeah, it'll do it. So for me, it gave me an opportunity at my own institution to then begin to interact with and collaborate with people such as Jim and Pam Sharma. And actually, I'll say, so when I first met with Jim and I was explaining our vaccine program, he's like, oh, I don't know if that's going to work. And he's like, you should be interested in this. And he pointed out checkpoint blockade. And he actually then was kind of the push for me. And that's when I did my first study looking at PD-L1 expression in triple negative breast cancer. We basically got about 100 patients we'd operated on and found PD-L1 expression in 20% of them. And that led to some work in the lab to think mechanistically about it and really was my springboard to becoming involved with the pivotal trials that established a role for anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 therapy in breast cancer. When I moved to the Dana-Farber, the opportunity was to come here and really help build their breast immuno-oncology program. I thought it was interesting that we had here, you know, world-renowned clinicians. We had clinical trialists who were internationally recognized, and we had basic investigators. Interestingly, I knew people in all three of those silos. They didn't know each other because that's just how it was. So I saw this opportunity to break down some of these silos. One of the things, though, that was a big consideration for me was that if I were to move from MD Anderson, would I be stepping away from the Parker Institute, which I've mentioned the benefit at my own institution, but also, as you're well aware, I mean, what other organization has pulled together these world-class scientists from institutions where they actually, when we meet together, we talk about the science, we share data, we don't hold back, we're not worried that somebody might scoop us or something like that. I mean, it's a very special environment. And to Jim's credit, he talked to the Parker Institute and said, we'd like for you to continue supporting her work. And then once I got here, you all, the Parker Institute, of course, I think we're already probably in conversation with Lori Glimcher. I think it's because the Parker Institute recognized, of course, not only her expertise, but in her position as the CEO, she had really built the immunology effort here at Dana-Farber. And so it was a real privilege for me being able to build on my experience from MD Anderson to work closely with Lori. And then we, of course, pulled in Kai Wucker-Fennig, the chair of immunology here, as well as Steve Hody, who's internationally recognized for his efforts in the clinical trial space. And we're able to, I guess, write a fairly compelling document suggesting that we at the Farber could be valuable members of the Parker Network. So it's been fun.
What's been, you know, as the center director there, what has been the most exciting part about the PICE Center and what you're building?
What I found very enjoyable early on as we thought about what we would be offering to the Parker Institute was the opportunity to do a deep dive on my colleagues here at Dana-Farber, because I, of course, knew what was going on in the breast space and I kind of knew what Steve was doing in the melanoma space, but just to see the depth of the science by some of our colleagues. So pulling that together and making, again, a argument as to why we should be involved. What's been rewarding since we became a center and kind of formalizing our effort here at Dana-Farber is to see how all these folks are now collaborating together. So as an example, you know, Eric Smith is very interested in cellular therapy, primarily T-cell therapy, Rizwan Romi and K-cell therapy. And then Dave Barbie was doing things mechanistically with the STING pathway. And wouldn't you know that the STING pathway probably, believe it or not, inhibiting it inhibits T cells. But oh, by the way, it might augment the response to NK cell therapy. And so now to see the three of them working together and to see their presentations and just see the community that we've been able to build has been incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, it's amazing. So you and I met recently in New York at a symposium co-sponsored between the State of New York Empire Development Fund and Parker Institute focused on diversity in clinical trials. This is something I know that you've been really excited about and pushing forward. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays into your vision for the Dana-Farber Center?
Sure. So I will first start by acknowledging that at the Farber and Boston more broadly, we're not necessarily the most diverse community, but we do have an opportunity to make ourselves more accessible to a diverse patient population. So one of the things that we've been very grateful for from the Parker Institute is some additional support, which has allowed us to put in place three initiatives around DEI. So one of them was to have a summer opportunity for nine students who would be considered URMs to spend time with us in our Parker labs and go through some lecture series. Another is the opportunity to support two postbacks who are URMs who are doing that work in Parker labs. And three, and to the point, the question that you asked me, we've been able to put some resources into some of the materials that we provide for our clinical trial programs. And it's beyond immunotherapy. It's all of our clinical trials that have enhanced the training for our research staff with respect to clinical trials and how we present our trial opportunities to our African-American population. And our hope is that ultimately that will result in increased participation of those studies.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's a big initiative at PICE. I think it's one that that we're going to continue to support and to push forward. It's wonderful to have leaders like you that are on the forefront of that. So, you know, part of this also, I think, is both from the DEI standpoint, but also from the development standpoint is mentorship. And so why is mentorship so critical, you know, in your career at moving forward with great leaders like Jim and George and others that you've worked so closely with? But also, what is your view on kind of mentorship on the students and postdocs that you've got coming out of your group?
So mentorship is something that I think of as paying it forward because I benefited so greatly from mentorship early in my career. And one thing that I tell folks is that for me, it was important to have multiple mentors. So I had some mentors who I'd consider my scientific mentors, and then I had clinical mentors. And it's really phenomenal to have been able to learn from those folks. Another thing that I do is I differentiate mentorship from sponsorship. Equally important besides having strong mentors was that many of them transitioned to being sponsors. And so George is a great example of that. He mentored me early on about these vaccines, and then he sponsored me by allowing me the opportunity to actually become the PI on these trials. So there was no ego with George Peoples. And so in my own role, I think one of the things that I enjoy most in what I do is building or pulling from what I learned in my own career to set up infrastructure and opportunity for my more junior colleagues, some of whom I consider my mentees and some of whom I sponsor for opportunity. So I think it's critically important that those of us who have benefited from that type of support in the past, again, pay it forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is a good piece of advice that you would give a young scientist looking to break into immuno-oncology?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So
sure.
I think it's interesting in that when I broke in, I was doing it against the grain, and now it's very much the grain. You know, a lot of people are interested in immuno-oncology. So I think the advice that I would give folks, and this is probably advice that I would give broadly as people consider their careers in medicine and in science, and that is to find your passion and then believe in it and work hard. If you have a good idea, it'll see the light of day. I think a lot of people get frustrated when initial grants don't get funded or papers don't get published, but I suspect if we were to have Jim, again, referencing back to Jim Allison as part of this conversation, he would tell us how many times he was basically heckled on the stage and told there's no way, or his papers were, rejected. So again, if you have passion for it, I think, and you have a good idea, to just keep at it and continue to find those people who believe in you and are willing to support you in your efforts.
Well, this absolutely, that kind of persistence really does reflect everything you've done, Beth, throughout your career. And how, as long as I've known you, it's been exactly that. You know, one of the things when we do look forward at the development of technology, and it's accelerating so quickly. And one of the biggest areas now that I think we'll obviously still be implementing in the next 20, 25, 30 years is AI and machine learning in all aspects of life. But in medicine as well, you know, there's been recent publications on ChatGPT and with physicians, you know, going head to head in comparisons. There's this big move in that direction. You've had a recent study on ChatGPT and breast cancer. Can you talk a little bit about that? What were surprising to you about the findings?
I'm happy to talk to you about that, because it actually flexes back on what we were just discussing, which is mentorship and sponsorship. So this was an effort that was initiated by Dr. Clara Park, who's one of my junior colleagues. She was probably correct in thinking there's going to be a lot coming out about AI. And so her question was, do you think our patients ever use ChatGPT to figure out what they're supposed to do with their breast cancer diagnosis? And so what I did was to pull in a group of patient advocates that I'd actually worked with since the time I was an assistant professor in Houston. We used to call them Beth's Posse. And in fact, when I left Houston, that was a hard group to leave behind. So we pulled them together. We asked them to please help us come up with a list of 10 questions or so that they as patients might ask of ChatGPT if they were diagnosed with breast cancer. Then we actually went, well, we being Clara, asked ChatGPT the questions. And then what we did was to ask some of our colleagues who are within the breast cancer space in the multiple disciplines to rate the accuracy of the responses from ChatGPT. And I think what we found is that ChatGPT was okay, but it certainly was not a surrogate for a physician. But the thing I would note is the technology, just in the time that we had to address the reviewer comments to our manuscript, the technology advanced. And so there's, as you allude to, there's tremendous interest in AI and how it's going to be applied in medicine broadly, in oncology very specifically. And I think it's already here where, as you're aware, AI is being used to help us to expedite the identification of which molecule we should be moving forward. It's going to be critically important in clinical trial design going forward to make our trials much more efficient, which is going to be really important in immuno-oncology, where there's just so much coming out. How do you know which patient population to put on which trial? So from a scientific standpoint, and then of course the personalization of an individual patient's care, I think that's going to, AI is already here and it's only going to become a bigger part of what we do.
Absolutely. Tremendously exciting. I love the what you mentioned on actually in all aspects. And this year's Nobel Prize, of course, in physiology medicine to AI team and machine learning and protein is exciting. But the clinical trial design is really exciting, particularly in a feedback kind of biomarker driven way. I think this would be something that would be a huge advance for patients and maybe get us closer to effective therapies with fewer patients in trial. It'd be really exciting.
Yeah. And then reflecting back on that conference you and I attended about 2 weeks ago, you'll Absolutely. Recall that investigator from Memorial Sloan Kettering applied AI to their incredibly large clinical database and then their impact database, where they had all the sequencing and were able to very quickly identify patients who would be eligible for a trial. And also incredibly interesting, somehow they figured out which patients on certain investigative therapies were at risk for developing a blood clot, so they could figure out who they needed to prophylax with anticoagulation. So, I mean, there's no way that a human chart review could have ever revealed that. And if that's the way that we can identify patients for appropriate studies and to make certain that they're well cared for, then that's a significant advance.
So getting back to the opening questions about medical school, I guess medicine and how we train physicians is going to have to change, you know, to incorporate this. And I'm sure there are med schools that have thought about this and tried to build this into the curriculum or thinking about doing so.
Yeah, I would presume so. And actually, if I think about the arc of my own career, not only is AI very different, but just the way that we do science. So when I started off very early, I felt like in my lab, I needed to know how to do, and I actually could know how to do everything from performing the experiment to analyzing the data to troubleshooting and everything else. That's not how we do science anymore. It can't be how we do science. And so in some ways, I feel sometimes a little helpless in that my team is generating these robust data sets and I don't have the computational expertise. And so I think that not only the way that we're going to train folks in medical school, but the way that we're training folks in PhD programs is largely changing as well.
Yeah, that's really insightful. I think that it becomes really a team of experts that comes together around a problem. And it is fundamentally different than, you know, complete understanding, but ultimately, hopefully it'd be certainly better for the patients and better for our understanding. So, you know, when we start thinking about the direction of your career, and there's a question I always ask people, if you didn't go into science, research, and medicine, what else would you have done? I mean, you started out with such a focus on engineering, and it seems like there were many opportunities, but where do you think you would have pursued?
I assume you're looking for a serious answer, but my response is I would have loved to have been a professional tennis player, but
let's go. Yeah. That's great.
I joke that I already mentioned that I played soccer at Duke. And you're probably of an age where you'll remember the name Mia Hamm. Does that
ring a bell? Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So Mia was, obviously one of the legends of women's soccer. And I played against Mia in high school and again in college. She was at UNC. Mia Hamm has no idea who I am, but I clearly have tried to impress people a number of times by saying that I played against her. But as I joke many times, I wasn't good enough to make a living at it. So I had to, you know, go to medical school. So it's a good question. As I suggested too, I didn't go into college thinking that I would go into medicine. I thought I would go to law school or to business school, but something just kind of bit me about the opportunity to do meaningful work that positively impacted people, and medicine seemed like a pretty good way to do that.
You know, the arc of your career has just been fantastic, or continues on to be absolutely incredible. And, you know, seeing you in action at the Parker Institute at Dana-Farber and working with you to build that up has been really spectacular, Beth. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining me today, sharing your perspective. Can you tell me just sort of where can listeners learn a little bit more about your research?
So we've got a number of efforts that are ongoing that we are very appreciative of the PICE support for. You know, we've talked about we've alluded to the fact that immunotherapy for breast cancer now is in the preoperative setting. So some of the work that I had done previously around PD-L1 expression led to my opportunity to help define the role for checkpoint blockade in the preoperative setting. And so, John, as you're aware, we know that patients that get preoperative systemic therapy, if they experience a complete response, they have an improved prognosis. And a certain percentage of patients will do that with chemo alone, and others really require that IO. And so work that we're doing that hopefully will see the light of day soon in the public is looking at factors that predict response to really who needs that additional immunotherapy. So one line of investigation is the NeoTribute study that you referenced earlier, where we're looking in tissues. And this is collaborative work with Dr. Wooker Fennig here at the Farber. And then in a new line of investigation is thinking about the peripheral immune system and whether the change in the peripheral immune system once somebody starts the therapy can predict who's going to respond. So hopefully, I was actually asked to do a little thing here locally of my prediction for what's going to happen in my field in 2025. And I suggested that our group and others will probably help to identify the biomarkers differentiating who needs immunotherapy for early stage triple negative breast cancer.
So everyone should keep an eye out for that research, the interaction with the systemic immune system and that intratumor microenvironment and pushing it forward. So Beth, I just want to thank you again for joining us for just such a great conversation and just highlighting the fantastic work that you've done. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been fun.
You've been listening to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, where Dr. Elizabeth Mittendorf shared how a singular vision became a movement. In the PICE network, Dr. Mittendorf discovered something extraordinary, a scientific home where walls between institutions dissolve, where knowledge flows as freely as inspiration, and where the pursuit of cures eclipses all else. Now, as she carries the spirit of fearless collaboration from PICE into her role as ASCO's next president, the momentum builds. One researcher's journey illuminates a pathway to tomorrow's breakthroughs. To learn more about Picey and stay up to speed on the latest discoveries, join our newsletter by visiting www.parkerici.org. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran. Join us next time on From Bench to Fireside.